Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this issue commentary. So this is the podcast where we take you behind the scenes of the issue that's on sale at the moment, if you're listening to this August 2017 time. So, yes, this is the September 2017 issue. If you haven't got a copy, it sounds slightly strange, but stop listening to this podcast. Go out and buy one. And then open it up and start listening to this podcast again, because I'm not sure if much of it will make sense unless you've got an issue in front of you. Either way, we're happy to have you as part of the part of this game. It's an interesting issue, though, this one, isn't it, chaps? Because actually, I should introduce everyone, shouldn't I? Really, I'll do that. So we have in the room, we have Damon Cogman. Say hello, Damon.
Hello, Damon.
Simon Aaron, our features editor.
Good afternoon.
And Lyndon McNeil, our photographer.
Hello.
Damon's our art editor, who's had a he's had a busy month, actually. So if you have a copy of the magazine in front of you, you will see why Damon's had a busy month. Because this cover, Damon, it feels like we've been putting this one together for the whole year.
Yeah, well, we had a an idea many moons ago about this celebration of Stirling Moss at Pescara, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more about the feat when we get to the feature bit. But the main gist of this wonderful painting that Tim Lazell has done for us. It's incredible. We talked about it a little bit a while ago, and it's taken a while to come to fruition. But wow, what a wait! It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, we. Yeah, it has been about 6 months we've been talking about this. And originally it wasn't actually going to be the cover, was it, Tim?
No, we just decided that we were going to go to all this effort, and Tim was creating this amazing piece of artwork that how could we not put it on the cover? It was incredible. So what?
Yeah, exactly. And actually one of the key things we had to do during the sort of development of the image was actually switch its orientation from landscape to portrait, didn't we? That was
yeah. Front covers tend to be the other way around, so yeah, that's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, we had a chat with Tim, and we said, look, this is such a good concept. We'd love to put it on the cover. We said we need it to be flipped from landscape to portrait, and we actually also asked him to try and create a little bit more space in the top kind of third of the illustration. Why was that, Damon?
Well, we need with the front cover, you just need the room to put cover lines, put actual words on, because it'd be lovely to just have an image without any words at all. That'd be the dream. But in this world of selling magazines, you need to tell a bit more of the story. So you have to invent a bit of room up the top in the sky area to kind of leave a bit of room for words and telling the story.
That's true, yeah. And I think the thing that Tim does so well is that he creates a sort of an angle of view that you would never be able to see unless it was through an artist's eye, if do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, because of the way that his sort of, forgive the phrase, but the pop art style allows this kind of centre of focus in the middle of the picture, and it kind of explodes out from that, which kind of gives you this incredible perspective that is a style that's often copied by many people and never bettered, of course.
Yeah, I think Tim... Well, I think he does it best, doesn't he? It's fabulous. Lyndon, I'll get your viewpoint on this, because obviously we've put an illustration on the cover this month and not one of your photos. Don't get worried. It doesn't...
Stop painting every cover.
But, you know, tell us from your eye, what do you see here? And, give us your appraisal of this cover.
I find it more striking than an actual photograph. It draws you in. It's, like you say, Tim is a fantastic painter. And just the lines that he can create that you can't actually create in a real world just draws you into that picture even more than a photograph can.
And the incredible thing about Tim Starr is that he paints it in blocks of colour. So there's no shading, there's no fine sort of work like that. It's all actually, it's just pixels. It's like squares of colour, which makes it even more incredible, the definition and the kind of the what he can... The, the picture he can paint with just blocks of colour is pretty incredible.
What do you think, Simon? Do you agree? Do you like this one?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's not the first time Motorsport has had a painting on the cover, but I think it's by far and away the most spectacular painting it's had on the cover. I think Tim's done a great job, and also
Wasn't that the one with
It was back in 1970. It was a painting. It was just a portrait painting. Not the most.
Wasn't it Dave?
Dave Warcraft had won the Motorsport Formula 3 Championship.
But,
on
that original painting as well, we had the frame, the gold gilt edge frame.
The frame was included. Yeah, it didn't have quite the impact that this does. And I think also Tim deserves a great deal of credit, because the amount of colour reference material from Pescara in 1957 is incredibly limited. There's very, very little. I mean, there are some colour shots, but they're not of fantastically high quality, and they are few and far between. So I think, all in all, given the material he had at his disposal, I think he's done a wonderful job.
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly stands out on the newsstand. So take a look if you haven't got your copy already. You'll see it quite literally leap out of the newsstand. It's a cracker this month. So let's jump into the contents. The regulars. So you have Matters of Moment, which is my editorial leader. I have mentioned in here some racing that I'm continuing to do with Ed Foster's MGB. Ed used to work for Motorsport. He's now moved on to Goodwood, but he was very generous, actually. A few weeks ago, he let me race his car on my own. He was otherwise engaged, and I had a good go at Snetterton, and Simon turned up to watch, which was fantastic. I needed the support and some talent as well, actually. Did you enjoy yourself there, Simon?
Yeah, no, I did. As regular readers of the mag might have noticed, I quite enjoy going to club racing and taking photographs of MGBs and stuff, and I have to say you acquitted yourself very well. Came from a rubbish qualifying performance through gained 16 places in the race. That was a very good effort.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I didn't pay him to say that either. That's brilliant. Yeah, that was.
I think the Marco Polo needs to mention at this point as well, where you're coming into the paddock based like a some sort of gangster with your.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so the story is we're definitely going off tangent a little bit, but okay, so Mercedes Benz have a camper van called a Marco Polo, and it is the most exquisite camper van you've ever seen. It's just it's a long way from kind of air cooled campers that catch fire. This is a Damon's a fan of air cooled VWs, but this is very much the sort of a luxury glamping side of things, and we're using it to tow the MGB. So this thing's got an electric pop up roof. It's got a pop up. What's it got? It's got a cooker, fridge. It's just got a leather seats, radar cruise control. It's got the whole lot in it.
It's just four star luxury in a van, isn't it?
It is four star luxury in a van. Five star luxury,
five star.
I think.
Five star, yeah.
I think you'll find. Yeah, 10 star. And I've borrowed a trailer from a company called Motorfin, which it's effectively the Rolls Royce of trailers, and it's. It's exquisite. It's all made of aluminium. It runs on air suspension. So the car, while it's travelling at 70 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour. Yeah, I should really gen up on the towing rules. 60 miles an hour. Just glides along on its air suspension, and it's got all these amazing little cubby holes in it where you can store your wheels and your fuel and everything else. It's just the most brilliant thing. So of course, I rock up into the Snetterton paddock, and
it's exactly what you don't need for an MGB at a club event. Clearly,
we could probably got three MGBs in it, to be honest. I turn up, and then I suddenly realise that yes, I very much look like the all the gear, no idea, which was bore out in the race actually. So, but there we go. So we do. Simon comes to watch. I'm playing on the racetracks various weekends throughout this year. I'm doing a 3-hour relay at Silverstone with the UKIP GTS guys. Come and find us. Yeah, it's a 3-hour relay race. It's going to be hilarious. And I'm in a team of three or four drivers and two cars. It would take me 2 hours to explain the rules, but it's going to be fascinating. So, and when is that? That is September the 30th. So if you're anywhere near Silverstone, September the 30th, come and watch me. Simon will be there, I'm sure.
Silverstone's not so hot for photographs. It's not the best. I might find an excuse to go somewhere else that weekend, but I will be coming to watch you at Alton Park. September.
Of course, September the 2nd, Alton Park. Yeah, come and watch me there. Or watch the MGB with hanging its inside front wheel in the air. It's good foot off the ground in most corners. So anyway, right, let's move on. So we've got our usual regulars, international racing, story about the Silverstone and the future of the British Grand Prix. Some fascinating stuff in here. I think we've really got to the bottom of this issue. We know that it will drag on for a while, but we promise you that we'll stay on top of this story. And then we have a fantastic report from Mark Hughes, Azerbaijan, Austria, and the British Grand Prix. And there's a striking image here, Damon, of page 39 of Vettel's Ferrari with a delaminating front left. Well, I think it's more than delaminating, actually, isn't it?
I think
delaminated.
I think that tire's probably seen the end of its life, hasn't it? Yeah, I mean, there was plenty of TV coverage of the tyres letting go at the British Grand Prix, but there was very little photographic evidence. So we actually got an LAT shot here of Vettel's car about to sort of run onto its rims, but there weren't many options. Surprisingly, for such a big event, the photographers kind of went sort of whizzed past at such a rate. I think he was on a mission to get back.
It's also the end of the race, isn't it, where people are getting ready for podium, checkered flag shots. So people aren't out on the circuit at the time. So we were very, very lucky to get that one image.
In the spirit of this, the behind the scenes nature of this commentary, can you tell us what equipment you need, how you know where to stand as a photographer? I mean, this image is incredibly sharp. You know, you can see the sort of gills in the brake, in the inlet, on the brake side. You can see the sparks popping off of the end plate, but the photographer's
miles away.
So tell us about the, because it's all in the technology, isn't it?
It's nothing about the photo. It's all about
there's
technology.
There's no talent. Yeah.
No, go on, Lynn. Tell us how you weave the magic.
I mean, this would have been either a 500 or 600 mil. So because of the length of the gravel traps and safety now of runoff areas, you're kind of put further and further back. But you just carry longer and longer lenses, so it's 500 or a 600 mil with maybe converters on top as well to make it a 700. But you'll do a track walk a few days before, so the Thursday of a Grand Prix you'll do a track walk, so you can kind of see where holes in the fences are and where you can and can't stand, and you just kind of preempt what could happen, so you know where to which corners where you might get a few action shots, a few incidents and accidents, and it's kind of all in the pre-planning, basically.
Yeah, you mentioned about the fact that the photographers all sort of about 5 laps before the end of the race all disappear back to the pit area, don't they, for the presentation? Yeah. So there is, if anything happens in the last 5 laps, usually it's missed, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, just thankfully, I think Jacob was still out. Jacob Ebrey was still out on track at the time, and was just fortunate enough to be there at the right place at the right time.
It's always quite interesting. I mean, I'm no longer working full-time in Formula 1, but whenever we went to a new circuit on the Wednesday or the Thursday beforehand, people were doing track walks, and journalists and drivers would be walking in the correct direction to see what the track looks like from the driver's perspective, or sit for the drivers to see which way it goes. And the photographers are all walking around anti-clockwise because they want to see what the angles are like from where they'll be taking photographs and the car's angle of approach and all that sort of stuff.
We're a backwards breed.
Damon, is there any comment there on...
I couldn't possibly say.
Okay, so we're going to dive straight into the features. It's a cracking month. And Damon, do you know what? Again, talking about images, the opener to the Richard Williams Pescara piece of Sterling with the bottle of water, I'm sure that is. Could be some vino, but good luck. How did you find this image?
Well, this is one from Paul Honoré Caillé, who's an incredible photographer who, or I should say from his dad, I would have thought. But the image itself, my God, nothing sums up a road race more than the dirty goggles, and the helmet with flies and muck all over it.
The 74, isn't it?
Yeah.
74.
Yeah. Designers left the page numbers off, so it's some sort of fall. but every detail in this image just screams sort of
dirt and filth and kind of the grime of that kind of road race, 1,000 miles of, or how many hundred miles of road racing that he's just completed. How you sum up a whole sort of event in one picture, and I think there you go, that's it, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it's just the string back driving gloves, the open neck collar, it's the sort of streak of oil over his crash helmet. It's just got absolutely everything, hasn't it, this image. So a great story on this anniversary of Pescara, but one of the reasons we wanted to look so closely at this race again is that there was an anniversary party, and Richard Williams was invited to this summer party, and Lyndon, you accompanied Richard. How did you find your 3 days on the wonderful coast of Italy?
Absolutely, it was a tough job to do, but I'm sure somebody had to go out and do it, and thankfully it was me.
So tell us about the ups and downs of that trip, because I know it wasn't as easy as maybe it sounded.
The downs, it was not speaking Italian and only having Italian colleagues to work with, which could have, well, it did leave us in a bit of a predicament. When I asked what route we were going to be doing on the Saturday, I got handed a road book and went, follow that. So you're driving on your own, trying to be in front of cars on a route that you have no idea where these cars are going to go. Was a little bit daunting. So it was just a case of chase and overtake, and then park up, turn around, take some snaps, chase again, and find some other cars to capture. But then the rest of it was brilliant, and then Google Maps took me around the circuit. So
and on page 82, there's some lovely snaps of the actual circuit sort of the roads as it is now.
Right, yeah.
Not circuit, I guess, but
with original curbing and still some markings on the walls.
It's incredible to think all these years later, there's still remnants of that still there.
It's fascinating.
So if you're ever in Pescara, go and find them.
Don't forget, if you subscribe to the digital edition of Motorsport, you can see these images in high resolution. I believe we've got a zoom function, have we, on that?
There's a pinch and zoom. There's all manner of good goodies in there to play with. So, yeah, some fully interactive thing.
And don't forget, if you're listening to this in the US, you can pick up your copy of Motorsport in Barnes & Noble as well. So, a fabulous story. And hopefully we've told, I think we've got to the heart of it. And then to sign off, we put together a kind of a behind the scenes of how Tim Lazzell pulled the cover image together. And you can see him working in his studio there. This is on page 87. And isn't it great to see an artist using natural light from the window, brushes, oils? It's great, isn't it, Damon?
Oh, it's fantastic. As a magazine designer, that's kind of what you dream of when you're kind of growing up. That's what you dream of doing, painting racing cars in a huge, lovely studio with all those kind of lovely things to play with. But yeah, in the modern world, it's a rarity. But Tim's a lucky guy, but he definitely earns it.
Right. We're going to jump on to... Oh, no, hang on. Simon's looking at me. He's got something to say.
I was just going to add that, I mean, much as I admire Tim's art, I will stick with the camera, because creating an image in 1/125th of a second is a lot easier.
Right, I need to say, actually, Damon's just reminded me, Motorsport, we're giving away, giving readers a chance to buy 60 prints of our cover image, signed by Tim Lazzell. And for full details, I think if you visit motorsportmagazine.com, I'm looking at our digital editor, who's nodding at me, yes. So we have one of 60 prints of the cover image, and I believe they're selling out fast. So visit motorsportmagazine.com, I would certainly recommend it, because it's an absolutely wonderful image. Right, we're going to jump onto page 90 now, and this is where I'm going to ask Simon a question, actually. Daniel Ricciardo. So this is a profiler feature on Daniel Ricciardo, written by Mark Hughes. I was thinking the other day, is there ever been another character in Formula One like Daniel? Isn't he a one-off, the way he enjoys his racing, and yet he's so extraordinarily talented?
And so laid back. And I think Mark portrays this very well in the piece. What you see is what you get. I mean, he's a ferocious competitor. We all know that. And I think I still think he's underrated for some reason. I don't know why, because...
Max. It's got to be Max.
Well, I mean, Max gets the hype, but you look at the stats of the two of them together, and, there's very rarely... Max is quicker sometimes, but it's never more than a gnat, and Daniel's quicker sometimes. And Daniel is also, as we've seen time without number, every bit as good a racer as Max is. And yeah, every time there's an opportunity or a sniff of an opportunity, three times we saw it in 2014 when he outpaced Vettel. Again, this year in Baku we saw it. He takes it.
I love that moment at Baku where, just before the restart, when he sort of was talking to the his boss Christian Horner and saying, "Yeah, I'll just overtake them into the first corner."
And he did. I mean, Baku, not an easy place to overtake. He did just the three cars in one move. I mean, he's an extraordinary talent. I think Mark has done. I mean, pinning down drivers during a Grand Prix weekend. It's not the work of a moment. But I mean, Mark did a great job to arrange quality time, good stint of quality time with Daniel at a race, and I think he's extracted a lot of the guy's character. I think he's an exceptionally good racing driver. I really rate him.
Yeah, I agree. I'm gonna ask you guys actually. So let's imagine that Ricciardo and Verstappen are both on the market. They're both the same price. You're a River Benny at Ferrari, and you can put one of them in your car. Which one, Max or Daniel?
Daniel, for me. I mean, I'm not saying that Max would be a bad investment. Clearly, he wouldn't. But I just think at this stage, Daniel's greater maturity. You still see with Max occasionally. I mean, some of the stuff that has happened this year hasn't been his fault. There have been reliability issues. There have been Daniel Kvyat issues. But I think at this stage of their respective careers, Daniel's fully formed, properly mature approach to racing, and just a fantastic racer.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. He'd be my choice in a heartbeat, definitely.
See, I beg to differ with that, because I think Danny's much more suited for Red Bull. With his personality, I think as a racer, yes, Ferrari, but I think personality-wise, he suits Red Bull much better than the corporate.
You've just asked a question that wasn't asked. You've answered a question that wasn't asked.
Maybe he would be offered the drive, but you would recommend that he should stay at Red Bull.
I think so, for just the way he is, and his whole personality suits that team much better than it does with Ferrari.
Okay. Well, while we are on hypotheticals, you don't know, I'm going to ask you this, but we're halfway through the F1 season, I think, or more, just slightly over. Who's going to win? That's it. Or this is absolutely it, because we've got four drivers in with a shot, two Mercedes, two Ferraris. Maybe the season hasn't panned out exactly as we were expecting for Lewis in particular, but this is it, guys. Cards on the table.
That's evil. If I had to put my money, I've changed my mind all of a sudden. No, I'm still going to put it on Lewis every day of the week, I think, because he's got he knows how to win championships, as does Sebastian. He's driving beautifully. He hasn't had a bad day for a very long time. He had a bad day off. I'm saying that, but actually he did earlier in the year. apart from one of the earlier races.
Russian Grand Prix, anybody?
Yes. I'm going to pass over. Clearly don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay, so Damon's going for Lewis. Damon's put down 50 quid. Everyone see that? Yeah. So, Simon.
There is a definite momentum. Hungary notwithstanding, there did seem to be a little bit of a momentum shift towards Lewis. I really don't have a clue. If I had to put money on it, I probably would give Lewis the very slight edge, but the caveat being not Vettel might do this or Vettel might do that, but the best driver this year, to my mind, has been Fernando Alonso, who won't be winning the title.
Yeah. I'm going to beg to differ again. I'm going to go Seb.
Okay.
I think Seb, he's got Ferrari behind him. He's got Kimi being told what to do. And I think that Valtteri will be a force to be reckoned with Lewis, because he's got nothing to lose for next year.
Well, do you know what? I think Lyndon's right. I hate to say it. I'm not the biggest Vettel fan after his jab at Lewis, but...
No, that's it.
So no, not Bottas or Kimi then, yeah? There's no fairy tale there.
I'd love Bottas to do it. I think it'd be amazing.
Jack's just put his hand up.
Bottas. Our digital editor is behind the recording desk at the moment. Is saying Bottas definitely. What do you know?
Yes, Bottas.
Okay. What, well, show money on the table? Yeah, Jack's disappeared. Yeah. Right, okay, let's jump into something very unusual here, but nevertheless, absolutely wonderful. Simon and Lyndon, please tell us the story behind this story, how it came about, and I'm pretty sure you enjoyed writing and shooting this one.
Yeah, I think...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'll pass the mic to Lyndon initially because he got the best of the deal because he got to go up to North Yorkshire to the... Hepworth's workshops, whereas I did my bit over the telephone. So, Lyndon.
Yeah, well, this has been nearly a year in the making. I saw Stephen at Goodwood last year at the Festival of Speed and just chatting to him while he was sat in his Can-Am BRM. And I just thought, he's got some fantastic cars. He was on about this four-wheel drive Formula 5000 that he was on about restoring of his dad's. And like I say, a year later, and it was back at Goodwood, but just before, we managed to go up to North Yorkshire and photograph it whilst they were still assembling it and getting it ready for the festival. So yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity and some great guys to go and meet and shoot.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Stephen competing many times. I saw this car in action at the currently resting Cholmondeley Power and Speed event, and it's a great thing. I mean, it won the British Hill Climb Championship twice. It was entered a couple of times in Formula 5000 races where it proved not to be all that successful, but it went back on the hills. And, you know, it's had a very checkered time the last sort of 40-odd years, being taken apart, stripped down, rebuilt without any kind of instruction manuals or guidance. David Hepworth, who built the car originally, sadly died a number of years ago, died very young in his early 50s. But the family have put it back together. And you know the tale of its resurrection. They've had to go, you know, jump through all sorts of hoops to, you know, I think they mentioned in the piece that the gearbox had to, you know, they built it about 9 times because every time they put it back together, they'd find there'd be a couple of grommets or washers that hadn't gone somewhere that should have gone somewhere. And I think Stephen said, yeah, it was about the 9th attempt, they finally decided that all the correct bits were there and in the correct places. But then when they first ran it, after they first rebuilt it, they discovered they'd actually mounted the gear selector back to front. So, you know, it was sort of not quite right, but it's fine. I mean, it's also interesting. The reason they did the latest rebuild was because they had to strip down the four-wheel drive transmission to do some reverse engineering for another project, which was an opportunity for them to pull it apart and put it back together again. But, yeah, lovely car. I think it's a very interesting story. I would say that. I mean, I love the opportunities we get in motorsport because people are very generous. People with older cars, they seem to love the magazine, which is fantastic. Talking to people who love who love the sport every bit as much as anyone around this table does and are just so passionate about what they do and why they do it. I mean, it's such a pleasure, such a privilege to be able to talk to people like that. And, you know, Stephen was one of those. I mean, we could have spent hours and hours and hours on the phone just chewing the cud about motorsport, and I'm sure he and I'll chat again in due course. And one nice little, it's a pity this didn't happen in time for us to include a scan in the feature, but replacing one of Lyndon's photographs. But a couple of weeks after this had gone to press, I was having dinner with friends, and one of them said, oh, I found some old race programmes in a cupboard. Do you want them? Which, of course, the correct answer is yes. And one of them was from the Oliver's Mount Hill Climb Scarborough in 1968, which was the event where the Hepworth made his debut. And to be given something like that, yeah, almost immediately after I'd written the piece was, you know, was just a quirky coincidence, but lovely.
Yeah, fabulous. I'm pleased to say that we're going to you know, we're going to continue with this. We kind of call them restoration stories, but they're not really. They're people stories, aren't they?
It's human and mechanical, but yeah. it's a cocktail of everything. I think they're lovely.
Yeah, we've got some great stuff coming up as well. So stay tuned. And next up, Lunch with Anthony Reid. Now, this is a cracker. It was an interesting conversation we had in the office around who should be the subject of lunch with. And there were certain people. Well, I won't mention any names, Damon. who just, you know, he quite rightly, devil's advocate, said, "Is Anthony Reid a suitable subject for a lunch with?" And I said, "Yes, he's got a story to tell, a wonderful story to tell." And Damon listened to my argument, read his P45 very closely, and decided that he would back down from that one. Listen, I know I'm teasing, I'm being awful, I know I am, but this is the behind the scenes, and we do discuss, don't we, who's right for this, who should be this, should it be an interview, should it be a news piece, should it be a web story, you know, and tell us, Damon, what are your thoughts on lunch with and our subject matters?
Well, it's a completely arbitrary kind of decision making, because it's based on who's a good story, and it shouldn't be about results, and it shouldn't be about anything other than will it make a good feature, will it make a good story, and I merely asked the question whether or not Anthony Reid would be a fitting lunch with, and I'm happy to say I was wrong. However, I feel he could have taken his hat off for lunch, though. I feel that's the height of impoliteness, surely, to wear a hat.
It was a bright room, and he did need shading from the Velux window. So. Okay.
All right. This is page 106, 107. We do, don't we? We do talk, we talk endlessly about who's suitable, the subject matters to cover. And unfortunately, Andrew Frankel, who's one of our contributors, so he's not always in the office, but he had a handle on this, didn't he? And he knew straight away how to get the best out of him. And he said from the start that he wasn't going to focus too much on the touring car days, because that's what people know from Anthony. And sure enough, I think he's just every other paragraph, there's a piece of information about Anthony that I'm pretty sure our readers won't be aware of.
Yeah, there's one bit that's missing, and I still I still feel bitter about this, but in 1983, I was supposed to have a run in the Works Argo Formula Ford 2000 car at Snetterton. And the day before, or the evening before, I was due to drive up there to drive the thing, I got a phone call from the guy in the team, a guy called Bob Moore, sponsor finder, who had arranged it all for me. And he apologised, said it won't be happening, I'm afraid, because Anthony's had a bit of an accident. Which a bit of an accident turned out that I don't think he'd crashed near the bridge. I think he'd actually crashed into the bridge.
Through the bridge.
Well, I don't know. I think it hit the old Snetterton Road, back in the glory days when there was still a little chef at Snetterton. I think he'd actually somehow cocked up the S's and struck the bridge parapet, and the Argo wasn't no longer fit for purpose. And I still haven't driven a Formula Ford 2000 Argo.
Well, maybe we can. All these years later,
and I've retired now.
We can sort that, Joe. I raced a Fun Cup a few weeks ago, and Anthony was a hired gun in one of the teams, and he was, you know, as you'd expect, he was right up the sharp end, and as you'd probably expect as well, I wasn't. So there came a point in the race where I was being lapped. I saw this car come screaming up behind me, going into Paddock Hill Bend, and I thought, wow, that closing speed is something else. I thought, you know, actually he's lost it, he's locked up, he's going to hit me out the back. So I kind of tried to move a little bit, expecting this car to whack me up the back, but it didn't. It turned in and went through. But just as he was turning in, I kind of lost it a little bit, not much, but I lost it on the marbles. And I'm pretty sure whoever was in that car, I'll tell you who it was, you probably guess, had a bit of a fright. So we go up the hill, I got the full fist wave. Yeah, from Anthony, and I returned, and I returned with a full V sign for two corners, and then I thought I should probably put both of my hands back on the steering wheel now, and then I thought, oh no, I've got a camera in my car. What if they? Oh, this has all gone horribly wrong, you know, and this is why I'll never be a racing driver, because I just can't concentrate. My mind just goes off into other areas. But Anthony, I'm sorry if I flicked you the V, and I certainly didn't mean to give you a fright into paddock. But thanks for the lunch with. Hope you enjoyed it. We certainly did.
Right, let's go into... Oh, well, this is a sad story, isn't it, Lyndon? This is your photo essay. This is the Manor Racing auction, page 116, 117. And as the Stand First says, following its enforced withdrawal from Formula One, Manor Racing's assets were split up and sold off. And you were there, weren't you, Lyndon?
Yeah, I went on one of the viewing days of the auction. And even the auction was quite a sad... lonely place to be. There was very few people there. Whether everybody had been looking online to get their bids,
it looked really eerie, didn't it? Because there's all these things laid out and with no one around to see them.
It was like an identity parade, you know, when you're trying to identify the body or something like that. Mm. But it was a really sad day to see all this. The bit that got me was of the helmets, all the pit crew helmets with the names on the back, and you just think that's somebody's career, that's somebody's life that's been drastically changed through lack of funding or through lack of points, shall we say.
And there's a one of the images there is a year planner as well with 2017's sort of dates all sort of marked in for the Grand Prix.
And the only thing that was marked was the 3 week enforced holiday, and that was it.
Very,
nothing
very
else.
Creepy. Yeah.
It was a very sad day.
Mm. And equally spooky, the wind tunnel model of the 2017 car as well. You know, this we mustn't forget that Manor haven't been replaced. You know, the Formula One is two cars down this year, and it shows, doesn't it? What do you think, Simon? Does it feel like the grip? It feels empty.
Well, I mean, I still kind of exist in a world where we had pre-qualifying and stuff in my head, so I think the grids have looked small for a very long time to me. But then I'm a bit of an antique. Linda's described beautifully what the auction room was like, but they were just as a team. You know, they didn't achieve a huge amount in their short existence, but they were such a good bunch of people, very down to earth, very approachable, not at all like certain other Formula One teams. And I mean, I remember the day before their debut Grand Prix in Bahrain, about four names ago, when they were still Virgin, in fact. And I was invited into the garage to one of the PRs. I said, oh, come and have a look, see how we're getting on. And they were still, I mean, the cars, this was a Thursday in Bahrain, 2010, and the cars weren't built. I mean, they were vaguely built. And John Boo, the team principal, Graham Loudon, the commercial director, they're all on their hands and knees and in the pit garages, you know, sawing away at bits of carbon and chopping up bits and bolting things together. And, you know, the following morning, the cars were on the track and running. But to see that kind of human endeavour, and for so little reward in the end, but it was actually, you know, you don't very often get invited into Formula One pit garages unless you're a paddock club guest or some such. But, you know, Manor stroke Virgin stroke Marussia wasn't like that at all. And you know, it was very nice to get a moment like that, to see something coming together. And I feel very sad that in the end it didn't work out.
As you mentioned, though, is a human part to all of this, because let's not forget that this is now the third team to go in 6 years, isn't it? It's started with HRT.
Well, the three that came in 2010, HRT, Caterham, Lotus Stroke Caterham,
and now they've all gone. We've lost three teams in 6 years, which is pretty bad, really, isn't it? Let's be honest.
They all came in on the basis of a price cap promise from Max Mosley, and they the price cap never materialised, and from that moment on, they never really had a chance, because they came in thinking they'd be able to do it for X, where X turned out to be several times X.
Yeah. Right, Simon, I'm going to stick with you, actually, because we're going to dive into Formula 2. Now, this is a kind of a two-part story. Starts on page... Oh, Damon, there are page numbers on this one again. Look. 1-2-2.
You have to guess the page. It's a competition. Surely you must maybe give away a Tim Lazell print or something if you can guess the page number.
Yeah, guess the page number.
We should do a free gift of little stickers with numbers on, and then we can stick them in the pages that you want to kind of get them on. But
I'm not picking on you, Damon. It's okay. I know it's a beautiful image, and I know you didn't want to put any page numbers on it. So, two-part story. The first part is from Dickie Meaden, our contributing editor, who is racing a historic Chevron B42 F2 car this year. And the second part is a wonderful piece, again, by Simon, and with a great headline as well, Band of Brothers. So, Simon, you're best placed to give us an overview of this story, this two-parter, in a way.
Well, I can't pass much comment on what it's like driving a Chevron B42 around Spa in the wet. But I mean, I think Dickie's done a very good job of conveying the difficulty of... I mean, Dickie's had a great deal of success in historic sports cars, historic touring cars and stuff. But there are some very, very good drivers in historic F2, guys like Martin Stretton, Martin O'Connell. You know, they are Matthew Watts. I mean, they're properly quick. I'm not saying they'd have been competitive in period Formula 2, but they are all very, very good drivers. And I think Dickie's done a great job of describing just, you know, what he's up against. Yeah. This year, and you know, they are. I'm sure most regular motorsport readers will be of sufficient maturity to have seen Formula 2 cars in period. I certainly didn't. I remember first reading about it in Motoring News. It would have been in the early 70s, and you know, there were sort of 35, 40 car entries for 26 places on the grid, and all these names, some of whom would become famous Formula 1 drivers, and many of you, and we didn't have the internet. You couldn't look up who, you know, obscure Italian A or B might have been. And you just I wondered about all these people. There's all these fantastic names. It just looked like a really interesting place to be. And I had the great privilege in 1984, unfortunately, as the championship was dying. It was my first season as a motor racing reporter working on an overseas beat. And, I mean, the Band of Brothers headline came really from my own personal experience of that year in 1984. There weren't so many teams then. There were about 17, 18 cars. But just the spirit of camaraderie between drivers, mechanics, journalists. At that stage, drivers are they're at a point in their careers where they need the press. They don't have a PR to arrange an interview at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. They came and talked to you. They'd phone you up. And, you know, there was a real... Everybody rubbed along. It was a cocktail of different languages and different cultures. But, you know, some really good young drivers... Great circuits we went to, Po, Misano, Vallelunga. I absolutely loved it.
Mugello, Misano, Enna. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I think I was the fourth different reporter in as many years to cover the European F2 Championship for Motoring News. But I loved it so much that I stuck around for Formula 3000 in 85 and in fact stuck around until Formula 3000 was canned at the end of 2004. And then I carried on watching GP2 races. So I kind of...
My part in their downfall is
this. Well, maybe. But I love that level of the sport. I mean, I love Formula One as well. But you get far more access to the people. And back when I was doing it, an awful lot of the teams were run by former F1 engineers and mechanics who didn't like the commercial element of Formula One and preferred racing a level down. And it was just a very, very engaging place to work. And, you know, I think it's only with high... And also the fact that you had chassis competition as well. Nothing was one make. Mm. So you had, you know, you had Roulton March in my day, but before that, Chevron, Lola, and so on and so forth as
Rondell.
Well, Rondell was a team. They did do their own cars. Yeah, they did.
True, yep.
They ran Brabhams and things, but they did do their own car eventually. But I was just incredibly lucky to work then. And as you look back, you realise... You know, at the time it was all very nice, but when you look back, not with rose-tinted spectacles, you just be looking at the way the sport has developed and all the one-make culture that's come in, and you realise how lucky you were to be there with all these talented, interesting people.
Yeah, great times. Right, so let's move on to the final feature in the magazine this month, and... goodness me, there's a feature here about drifting. Simon is the features editor. I mean, seriously, what's the... tell me, what are the drifting? Shocking.
This one was sort of snuck onto the flat plan without my noticing, actually.
Damon, maybe you can tell us a little.
Hang on a minute. it's great. We've got drifting in the magazine. That's really exciting. I think this is the first time ever. I'm fairly sure Body didn't have drifting in the magazine.
Body and Jenks weren't that keen, as far as I recall.
Okay, hands up. Yes, I thought this would be a good idea, and I stick by it. Basically, the FIA is embracing drifting. And when the news broke that there was going to be an FIA series, the FIA Intercontinental Drifting Cup, we started talking about it in the office. And I figured, well, if this has created a debate in the office, then it should create a debate amongst our readership. And we should propose, you know, we should put forward the story. We should explain its birth, its gestation, and we should introduce it. And I think that, it's kind of curious to go from a story on historic F2 to drifting, but I stand by it. And of course, and actually I have to credit Simon for the fantastic cover line, drifting four-wheel dressage, ? because there is this question, isn't there? Is drifting actually a competitive sport?
To all teasing aside, I mean, I do, and I know that there will be some of our traditional readers who maybe don't like the idea, but the fact is, the magazine's title is Motorsport, and I personally believe that we should embrace the sport in all its forms. You know, in my column I include all sorts of stuff, whether it's hill climbs, rallycross. You know, they're not the foremost branches of motorsport, but they are part of it, in the same way as sporting trials are and anything else. Drifting, you know, it is definitely a growing movement, and the fact that the FIA has embraced it tells you everything.
Yeah, I think the landscape of motorsport, is changing massively at the moment. We've got electric racing, we've got world rallycross at the moment proving incredibly popular. Why not drifting as well?
And world rallycross looking at going electric too. Yeah, that's being discussed. I mean, there's, you know, it is, as you say, the landscape is changing massively, and I think as a mag, yeah, we are duty bound to reflect that.
Thank God for that.
But I still didn't know it was on the flat plan.
By this one, honestly, yeah. No, it was. Well, if you were at Goodwood and you saw Mad Mike with his, it's an MX-5, isn't it, with a rotary engine. It's an RX-8 engine in a MX-5 with basically no exhaust pipe. The exhaust sticks through the bonnet. So you watch the onboard of that thing flying up the hill and doing donuts and stuff. Like, it's the sort of stuff that. Well, you know, I've got two young boys, and of course they go mad for this sort of stuff, and I don't really mind. I just want them to get excited about the sound of a high revving car and flames and smoke and all that other stuff, because they get interested in the mechanics then, you know. So, and I'm hoping that this will actually inspire a generation of motorsport enthusiasts.
Well, I went out to Sweden a couple of years ago to a big drifting event in I can't even pronounce it.
Sweden.
Oh yeah, that's it. There we go. Sweden. There we go. I was amazed at the technology that goes into it. It's not as sort of simple as it appears. The way the suspension's set up, the tyres, the diffs, the ratios, gearboxes, everything. It's an incredibly complex and technical formula.
And in spirit, is it a million miles removed from the specials that were built post-war by the garagists in the UK, use them in hill climbs and so on and so forth, and you know Jenks would write about those. There's a lot of homespun engineering in these things, and as Damon says, it's like drag racing. Everyone thinks it's just driving in a straight line, but as we all know, you know they've got 15,000 different head gaskets to choose from depending on whether the ambient temperature's 15 degrees or 16 degrees. There is a huge amount of complexity, and I think we should at least look at it.
You've got to also remember the talent of the drivers. You know, not everyone can just throw a car sideways when you're millimeters from your competitor. You know, same with drag racing, it's going in a straight line, but you are in complete control, and I couldn't do it, and I certainly couldn't drift either, not controlled anyway.
Nick's been getting cars sideways unintentionally recently.
I have. I've only spun once in the MG. Dan Trent, who wrote this story for us, I think he's done a really good job. And I was having a conversation with him about the technology in their cars, and I asked him about the tyres, because obviously they get a serious beating. But I asked him, surely these are kind of low grip tyres, or they're designed to smoke a lot, or whatever. And he said, no, actually they're really high grip tyres, because the drivers can't manage a transition with a low grip tyres. They need loads and loads of grip so they can do the, you know, where they do the sort of side to side kind of motion. So then you start to think, well, how fast are these things drifting? And then Dan told me this story of when he got the chance to drive this 1,360 horsepower GTR, and it's held the world record for the world's fastest ever drift, which 190.6 miles an hour. Can you imagine that? That's just extraordinary, isn't it? 190 miles an hour drift.
Will the MGB do 190.6 miles an hour?
Of course not. It's fully adheres to all the rules and regulations of the series. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, a great story. I mean, I can't say that we'll necessarily follow this up in print for a while, but I would urge you to seek out some video and keep an eye on the FIA Championship next year, because at the end of it is next year, isn't it? The Cup. is forming. So next year in the FIA awards ceremony, there'll be F1 and touring cars, and there'll be
a bloke with a baseball cap on backwards.
Exactly. Good on him. I'm going to have to round it up, aren't I? I think Jack's nodding at me because we've gone over. Goodness, we have gone over time. Listen, thanks as ever for reading, and I hope you enjoy this issue. We've had a lot of fun putting this one together, and also it's the last in this kind of style, because next month, the October 2017 issue, design and content evolution, which is
a refresh. Yes,
okay.
Yeah, everything needs a little look at every now and then, and motorsport's no different. But don't worry, it's not anything huge. It's just a little gentle massaging and a little few extra fonts and a few nice little tweaks here and there.
Okay, so you didn't mention the red cover.
No, there'll be no red cover. Don't worry.
There'll be no red cover. We can promise that. But yeah, please, keep reading. It's hopefully you can tell that we get an enormous sense of satisfaction putting this together and knowing that you enjoy this sport as much as we do. So keep listening, keep reading, and we'll see you next month.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.